A lot of our tools are the same.
I've been working on this graph material for about 5 years. I'm on a group with Denny Benavina at Clark University. He's a nice statistical physicist. We have several students, and here's some of the students that have helped with some parts of this talk. There's Joe.
We're going to use your stick here.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Canadian pointer.
Yes. Youth.
Who got the foul? Joe Kirk, Fernando Rosenfeld, and Jim Bagro. And these two guys from Los Alamos with Summer. Joe Skupka is a guy I met when we both taught at the Naval Academy. Actually, he's just about to move to Clarkson as a faculty member. And Dan Stilwell and his student at Virginia Tech. Okay. So we're going to talk about, to start, how famous is a scientist? That's the society part from the talk. So this was begun as an undergraduate project with Jim when he was an undergraduate. It was meant to be a bit of life fair, something you could do, but I've been shocked at the amount of attention it got in radio interviews and a lot of popular press about it. So but please take it in the light it was originally intended. So two slides just to background, so we all look at the same picture. What's a graph? Think of a graph as a picture like that. Formally, it's just a list of vertices and a list of pairs of vertices. So vertices are I through N, then the edges are vertices are I through N, edges are vertex pairs. The general topic that we study at Clarkson is random graphs. This is just a bit of a zoology, taxonomy, of some popular random graphs. These three. Actually, this one starts with this graph. This is the all-to-all graph. 10 vertices. Everybody's connected to everybody. If you say each one of these edges is there with probability p, start picking them out, you get what's called the ER model. This was the first popular random graph model studied by them some time ago. Problem. It's almost completely solved this problem statistically. You ask, is there a giant component? Is there a critical p, a probability of which this thing percolates, it's called, when the giant component essentially evaporates at a very sharp p value on average. And what a giant component means is there is essentially the majority of the graph is part of a connected component. You can get from anywhere to anywhere by some path. And that was the state of affairs until not too long ago, just maybe half a dozen years ago. And all of a sudden, the random graph theory blew up again, became huge, and everybody's studying it again. And I think it started essentially with this model, which is due to Watts, Strogatz and Watts model, called the small world model. And this was, you know, everybody, how many steps is an actor from Kevin Bacon? Or everybody in the world knows each other by a path of just a few people. It dates back to an old Wilhelm experiment. He sent letters out to the West Coast and tried to get them back to the East Coast by as few steps as possible. So Watts and Strogatz made this little model, which is essentially a ring lattice. And the original model isn't formulated exactly. This is almost the original model. You form a connection between I and J extra. These are short paths. With probability p, you just throw in a few long-range connections. It turns out that just throwing in a few long-range connections, that this graph has short paths from everywhere to everywhere. This was a great paradigm, and it was very popular for a few years because it's very easy to understand, but it's actually just pulled out of thin air. So it seems to capture a lot of what society-type graphs do. It's actually doesn't bear out when you actually go out and make surveys of graphs. It turned out that this kind of a model is much more realistic. It's called a scale-free graph. A scale-free graph was the first popular model was presented by Barabasi and Alger from Notre Dame. It's called scale-free because the degree distribution is essentially like this. The probability k, the probability density function, is distributed like k to the minus lambda. What this says is the probability of having a vertex with k links is distributed like this. So it's very unlikely that you'll have a graph with lots of connections, but there are a few. These are the hub guys. And the majority of the members are these non-hub guys, just a few connections. So there's a few popular members of the graph. And so there's the picture. You've got a big hub guy, sort of secondary hub guys, and the outlier guys. And it turns out there's a tremendous number of graphs in nature. Whether function graphs in protein folding to disease spread in societies, they tend to look like this through many different surveys people have run. Okay, that's a little bit of background for just language. Now for the the green part of the talk, how famous is the scientist? So I'm going to ask, who is famous? What is fame? And is fame linked to your merit in any way? We were inspired by a paper by the advisor was Wani Wachowski from UCLA. He did a very similar study for aces, he called the theory of aces. So in World War I, fighter pilots. So he rated your merit as a fighter pilot by how many enemies you shot down. And then for your fame, he did something very interesting. He just typed the name into Google and saw how many hits there were. And normally sociological data is rather expensive to come up with. And actually, Google is very expensive to set up. But it's already set up, so it's essentially free for us to use. And in a way, it's a reasonable kind of a survey because, in a sense, it's measuring how many people are noticing a person's name and writing about it, and how many links there are from such pages to other pages. So in a sense, it's kind of like people are voting with their feet. So that was the main thing we found interesting here, was that they decided to rate fame by Google hits.
And we're going to expect that those hits were based on their performance in World War II, or maybe there could be some correlation.
I'm going to criticize the whole work a little later, our work too, and say, well, what if you were a World War I fighter pilot that eventually became president of your country? Well, it's very hard to distinguish whether that that fame came from being a poor fighter pilot or becoming a good politician. It's hard to separate that. But it is a statistical study. If you take enough numbers, the assumption is that their fame comes from one avenue. So we can critique that assumption. Our paper is How Famous is the Scientist? Famous to Those Who Know Us, was the title. And that's something I was saying with my dad for a long time. Because the joke was, he used to always say, oh, science is doing so well, you're known all around the world. You know, give invitations to, you know, I've been to St. Petersburg, I've been to Switzerland. But I always see the same old people, right? You guys do the same thing. You go to Switzerland, and there's your 100 best friends. And then you go to Cincinnati, and there they are again. And you go to Japan, and there they are again. So when we write a paper, it's really about those 100 people that read our papers, and that's it. So are we really famous? So that's the point I want you to pull out of this with this Google study and all that, is I'm actually going to find quite a difference between popular groups and us.
The time is not there.
The what?
The time coordinate.
The time coordinate? No. How do you mean?
You may be famous for one day, and then you may not be famous one week later.
It's true, but I measured hits on Google, so I guess that stays for a little while. But I do have an end part of the talk, which is about time-varying networks, but not linked to fame. Because he's just spreading the time-varying networks, which is a critical component for that project. Okay, so here's some Google hits on some famous folks. So we know that guy. He got a big hit. And he's very rare, because he's entered the popular culture. Everybody knows who Einstein is. You can go to the gas station and ask the gas station attendant, who's Einstein, and they'll know something about who Einstein is. Isaac Newton, he's pretty up there, 1.6 million. Here's some other famous people. There's that guy, the brother. He beat Einstein. His sister, that's Janet Jackson, 1.5 million, and she had that Super Bowl fund last year. You have athletes, Michael Jordan and Tom Cruise. There's me, and I cheated. The lexicon I typed in what for most everybody was the quotes around the full name. And here's another place you should critique the work, in a sense, is when I type in Eric Bolt, E-R-I-K-B-O-L-L-T, you get 660. And of course, my name's a rare spelling. There's only two Bolt B-O-L-T's on the web. The other is my cousin, who's a tattoo artist. And you can get a tattoo of anyone in the world and see his art. And he's actually more famous than I am. I think more popularly so. But if you choose to cheat and get kind of pump my own fame up, if you just type in B-O-L-L-T, and you take E dot or Eric, there's actually a lot more for me. And I go up to 9,700. And I didn't do that for these folks, and particularly this guy. he's so darn famous that, you know, Newton's method, for example, there must be, you know, a gazillion hits on Newton's method that wouldn't have hit Isaac Newton. So it's difficult to distinguish those things, but these are the rules of the search. I'll specify the rules carefully when we get there. Okay, how famous are these guys? This is what I think is kind of funny. I chose an anonymous Nobel winner from the 1990s. And the reason I say anonymous, I was very afraid when I did this. I didn't want to pick on anyone in particular, because I had this bad thought that what if I pick on a guy in particular, he'd be in the audience. So I didn't want to do that. Or even if you're like the guy down in the office from the one I picked on. So I'm not going to tell you who it was. But I took a Nobel Prize winner at random from the 1990s, and I typed in their full name, and that's when I came up with the number of hits. And that's a pretty high ranking of merit. You won a Nobel Prize, and fairly noticed by the public. I'm going to hit that in a second. I took my very favorite field medalist, and I ran it by the rules of the search. I got 6,410 hits. And if I did the just the last name thing with S, I got this. So quite low for winning these great prizes. But that's not going to be our rating of merit. There's this guy. I came to Canada, and I thought hockey might be popular, and then he gave me this thing. And it turned out to be a home run. This guy got a bunch of names, too. Okay, so I asked you guys this. This before we actually do some numerics. I got some numerics coming. Can you name 10 Nobel Prize winners from the 1980s to today? And I bet most of you might have a hard time. And that's actually, this is a very biased sample, because you guys are physicists and mathematicians, I think, everyone in the room. And that's terrible if you guys can't name 10 Nobel Prize winners, because go to the gas station and ask that guy. Forget about it. You might be able to name Albert Einstein, but they might know if you won a prize. Now, each of you name 10 famous athletes, and then each of you name 10 famous movie actors. And you get my point. And now try to name, if you say, okay, well, science is important, go ahead and name any scientist, 10 scientists from a field that's not your own field. Like, name 10 economists if you're not an economist. It's kind of hard. So somehow we're not noticing that. I don't even like football or hockey, and I can name 10 of each. I hate those. I never watch them on TV. It just kind of squeezes into your brain. Okay. So I'm going to tell you in a little bit the famous mechanism. But this paper itself turned out to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. We wrote this paper, how famous is the scientist, famous to those who know us. We put that up on ArchiveX, and within a week, people started writing about it. And it wasn't even published yet. So you pick up a good title. And then first came this thing, they wrote about it in here. We would never would have dreamed of putting this paper in here. This was an undergraduate project for Life Fair for fun. And then once these guys wrote about it, I just lost track of how many other places wrote about it. I've been interviewed on the radio, and it's crazy. So you saw that I had one project with a professor from Virginia Tech, and he's in electrical engineering. He said he's walking down the hallways in mechanical engineering, or is it civil engineering? And he saw our paper posted on some professor's wall. It's not his area at all. He just stumbled across it. He left the title, so he put it up.
Quick question. You had 13,500,000 in the corner. Is that the number of hits for
paper? Oh, no. I'm sorry. That's a stray number. And I was going to make a slide for this, and I said not to, because I didn't want to insult anyone. But I will tell you the numbers. That's Jesus Christ. I hope I didn't insult anyone. I tried to make this PC.
Okay, did you ask about Mohammed?
What's that?
Did you ask about Mohammed?
I'm sorry.
Wow. Did you ask about?
No, I didn't. I was going to make a slide like that, and I decided it was a bad idea. And then like, that was literally a forgotten number in the corner. I never noticed until you pointed it out. Okay, here we go. This is the work of UCLA group, run by Juan Rosario. It's called the Theory of Aces. So it says, let fame be the number of times cited by Google. And let A, the merit achievement, be the number of enemy aircraft shot down. And they surveyed all 393 guys they could find, and they plotted. And they found a line on a log scale. And they started investigating, why is this so? Of course, there's this most famous guy. That's the Red Baron. He's not part of the survey. They made a model. It goes like this, as to, and this is the mechanism, what I mean by what fame is.
So that is a stochastic model. I'll get into it in a minute, but basically it's this picture. So they say it, a friend tells two friends, and those friends, this is, by the way, this was made in the context of populations, survival of populations, put forward by Barabasi, competition and multi-skilling, evolving efforts. And one applied it to this situation. They told two friends, and they told two friends, and they told two friends. And this is what they say is going on with the web pages. People aren't reading original sources. They're reading web pages, and they're putting their web pages up by making them click on those web pages and linking from links and links and links. So they made a model that basically goes like this. They said, an iterate equation, as in chemistry. So they said, let's let F be aces proportional to a rate constant, which is achievement. So ace K has a particular thing. Let N be the total number of web pages about the ace. And as N grows in time, people keep writing web pages about the fighter pilots, we say that the particular fame for a particular guy K grows according to this equation, is with the model, is assuming. Given that, eventually you can push this forward, and that's the time when you find that the probability of having a guy with a particular fame value scales like this, with scales like the scale 3 I'm claiming, with the gamma essentially like 2 plus something. From that, you can follow your nose through the analysis, which I'm not really presenting in detail. But you have achievement versus probability, which I'm telling you, and probability versus fame. And eventually, you get the result, I think.
So what was the probability of what?
I'd say it better here. This is the aces. The probability of having a guy with fame being the number of dual hits. So what's the probability that there is a, what's the probability distribution that the fame is some value? So fame would be the number of hits on the horizontal axis, and what's the probability of finding that on the vertical axis? This is a probability distribution function. And the other quantities to consider would be, is fame function related to your achievement? And then what's the probability of having an achievement? I'll get back to these in a second. Okay, so now for the scientists. Why are the scientists different? So, essentially we're a small group and we like to write about each other. So, and we're not just like write each other, we have to write each other about each other, because if we don't, then the director really sends it back and says, you forgot to cite me. Here's the 8 citations, and they're all referring to Joe Schmo. And by the way, I'm an anonymous referee, I'm not Joe Schmo. And that appears on our web pages, because we post a paper on preprint servers, we post them on our websites, those names appear there. So we're a finite small group of people who might read about, might read our paper, that's supposed to be our papers, and only people send to. So like of those 100 people who might read our papers, maybe half of them do. So I'm famous, that was my dad used to say. He's down famous. And I know internationally, around the world, to a few dozen people, and I'm known well to those studying Hemi-Sandy-Demi groups just like me. So is that true thing? And actually, I want to say it's popular thing. Let the mechanism of exponential growth be the definition of popular thing. By this definition, I don't think we end up being popularly famous. I have the data to figure that out in a little bit. So this is what I mean by how famous is a scientist, famous to those who knows. Cracking a big problem where you're winning a Nobel Prize isn't one popular thing, but it does have a scientific thing, which is that other thing that we like, and that's what we think. There's nothing wrong with it. And it's really respective peers. It's great. And, oh, I lost the rest of my talk. I went forward. See, I read these out of order. So that's okay. It goes well that way. So, how famous is a scientist? So, how should we measure fame? So I'm going to measure fame by the number of Google hits with the following lexicon. I actually picked up a particular group of scientists. I'm going to put the full author's name, actually I'll start with the author's last name, and condensed matter physics. Condensed matter. So that picks on a particular group of them. or statistical physics or statistical mechanics. Self-referential work, I'm doing a network study about people who do networks. And there's a reason this is a good group, because in statistical physics, we're going to put our measure of merit. We're going to count the number of papers that they posted on Preprint Server, archives. And the reason this is a good group to pick on is not all communities use ArchiveX as much as others, but statistical physicists in particular use it quite a lot. Of course, you can critique this too. For example, I appear here quite a lot, but only for my statistical physics stuff, because I often don't bother posting stuff for my nonlinear science stuff, because they don't read it as much in nonlinear science. Some people don't use it at all. So that kind of really pumps down the amount of work I have, but all my citations in Google are for the whole thing, the whole package. But in a sense, it's an averaging process. There's some technical difficulties. Full of the lexicon we can argue with. How PageRank really works with Google technology. Is posting to the archive an okay measure of merit, as opposed to, I only wrote 9 papers, but I'm girdle, so they're pretty good papers. He only wrote 9 papers in his career, but they have some big impact. When you're Newton, you write a paper, but people might refer to other people's papers about your original work. You can go on and on and on. But the point is, the good sociological data is very expensive to come by normally, and what I've done here is we have a way of collecting reasonable data essentially for free, because it was set up by somebody else. So just like in a lot of areas of physics, please excuse my spherical power. And this is sort of the empirical thing. Okay, there's a dramatic difference between the popular groups and the scientists. For the popular groups, we find that probability of a particular thing scales in this algebraic manner. And for famous amongst ourselves groups, we find this exponential decaying thing. Just thinking, the distribution of fame in science is clearly benefited by an exponential distribution. We find that fame for the famous scales this way, and fame for us scales algebraically instead of exponentially. And then you just put these two together. In both cases, you can change variables in the measure, and then you can find that differentially these statements make this guy, differentially these statements make this guy. And I've already read to you the conclusion, of course, being, well, what was different? The rate equation I showed you initially for the scientists, for the famous, essentially suits exponential growth. You can keep growing, tell two friends and tell two friends and tell two friends, there's an infinite pool of people that might be told. But for the scientists, once you tell 100 of us, the growth saturates. So you're really looking at linear growth. You're really essentially looking at linear growth. See, we have fame as a function of achievement or merit. It's essentially going linearly because C is essentially 1, just elbow grease. You write 10 people on average for the average scientist, you might get 50 people noticing you. You write 20 people paying papers, you might get, say, 100 people noticing you, and so forth. Proportional instead of exponential. So this talk consists of a bunch of small parts. That was the famous society. So probably better if you have questions or critiques that you ask them in the parts. That's what I say for the end. Should I move forward? Okay, related. What are communities? This is a graph partitioning problem. So the problem is, you give me a nice graph, and I want to detect if there's sort of groupings that communicate amongst themselves more. So what do I mean by a community? A community is a groups of vertices that are densely connected amongst themselves, but they loosely connect with the rest of the graph. Of course, I drew the graph here to be very easy to look at. You just look at it, you can almost eyeball it to tell it's a community. But you got to remember, it was a huge graph, say 1,000 vertices. And I didn't lay it out beautifully like this, but I laid it out at random positions. It would just look like a big hairy mess. It would be very hard to partition it in any obvious way. And I'm going to go forward a bit to to a canonical example. Here's a canonical example. So here's a picture of a graph that can be drawn in such a way that lots of connections amongst this subcomponent, lots of connections amongst this subcomponent, and very light connections between them. That's sort of the most extreme example of that. There's a very nice algorithm due to Newman at Michigan, University of Michigan. And he noticed the following. If I want to have a path that goes from here to here, I must go through the bottleneck. And so what he did is said, well, let's make all shortest paths from I to J, and let's count for each edge the number of shortest paths that run through that edge. He calls that betweenness. And so anybody over here to anybody over here, you're forced to go through that edge. So that edge is going to have a high betweenness. And that triggers that stall. That's a bottleneck. So he goes to the graph, counts the ones with the highest betweenness, and pulls the edge out, and they recompute. And then at some point, he breaks the graph into subcomponents that no longer communicate. Where this one would happen immediately. This and this would have a tie for the highest betweenness. Once you pull those out, then you would have two subcomponents that no longer communicate. You'd call each of those subcomponents a community. And he keeps going and makes subcommunities and subcommunities and subcomponents.
And would they increase in which way?
What's that?
Well, what is the time expenditure?
It's a very expensive algorithm. I critique it in two ways. But it works beautifully, it makes beautiful results, but it's very expensive. I believe it's O(n)4. It's approximately O(n)4. The edges and vertices are the same on order. Let's see. N cubed n plus m. Where n is the number of vertices, m is the number of edges. You got to run a breadth first search for the whole graph. And you got to run it between every guy to every guy. And for each time you pull on an edge, you got to rerun it. So it's n cubed n plus m, I believe. So it's exceedingly expensive. And the other critique is you need to have global information. So you gave the perfect question as to motivate why our work. So, well, communities are very important. You say you go out to society and you say, well, who likes who? Except when you do that, you have some sense of who your community is just by talking to your friends. And what you don't do is go and take the entire graph of the entire United States and ask who knows who, and then from that start removing edges until you get down to, aha, here's the eight people who are my friends. In some sense, you only need to look at some local information. And that's a theme in our group, is what can we learn about graph from just local information? So I'm going to present to you in a second a local algorithm. So applications are social networks, which is easiest to describe as social networks. But graphs are used to describe all sorts of things, from computing structures to how a drug or some other reactant might react in your body to protein-protein interactions and so forth. A number of different ways in which graphs are used in applications are tremendous. And then deciding how those partition into different types of function is tremendous. So most methods that are popular, actually in the last 5 years, there's been an astonishing number of methods produced, but very few are local. Most fall into two categories, either agglomerative or divisive. The method I just told you about by Newman is the divisive method. You go through and you pick edges out until eventually you divide it into a union. The other way is you throw away all the edges and you have some cost function. And you start throwing in edges in such a way as to try to minimize some cost function. Those are other techniques. So that's rewiring the network from scratch will optimize some cost function or parameter.
You only throw back the links that you had to begin with?
Yeah. So the method I'm going to show you actually doesn't fall into either of these categories. And we like it because it only uses local information. Okay, here's our method. Here's an overview of our method. So, take a graph and choose some starting vertex, you. You take it, your position. And we're going to spread out, we're asking information as we go outward from step to step to step until some criteria has been met, and I'll show you what that is. And I'm not going to need any information beyond how far I spread. So, let's say that's me, I'm J. And I'm going to make Dan, you can call these chemical shells, you can call these breadth first search shells. They're all those vertices which are K steps away from J. So all the guys that are 0 steps away from J is J itself. And I'm going to say how many emerging edges are there from J? And on first step, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I'll say K, 0, J is 5. And then we go out one step. So all these guys are one step away by shortest path from J. How many edges emerge from that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7. In this little mini picture of a graph, if I were to draw a ball around that, on the next step, there's 0 edges emerging. So I have these numbers, and the algorithm is stopped in this case. And I'm going to say, after I'm going to make change. So I make this quantity. It says, how does it change from one step to the next? And you can see that the ratio of these numbers is 7 over 5. And then 0 over 7. It's been a big drop. That big drop is going to signify that if you've reached an edge of a tightly connected group, which is a notion of community.
How did you get this KJ2 is equal to 0 there?
KJ2. The next shell, if you draw around this whole thing, and there's no edges emerging from it. Normally I wouldn't go.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, if there was, say, from here, a connection to some large component, then it would drop to 1. Yeah. So I just hold you there. And then we have a stopping right here. It says when this change makes a big drop from some threshold, you say, oh, well, those ones I've collected so far, I call that a community of vertices that are tightly connected amongst themselves. We call that a community. You know that we have to start at one position. That's actually J's notion of its community. Which isn't to say that it's going to give the same result as me. Here's a result from a very famous, it's a canonical example these days in the partitioning communities, Zachary's Karate Club. People like it because there's actually a historic split. So the idea was there's this karate club of children, and they had a karate club. And there were little cliques in there, and people were friends with each other. And at some point, they decided that they didn't like each other, and they split into 2 karate clubs. And the historic split happened somewhere in here. And I forgot actually which guys went in which direction. And people use that as the right answer. And I've seen people give talks where they say, you've got to get your algorithm, you have to give that right answer, or you're in the bad algorithm. And actually, I don't believe in that at all, because the edges in this graph were drawn by asking children, who are you friends with? And it doesn't take into account, there might have been other factors that went to the split. So this is just my own opinion, but maybe 2 of them went together, because even though they're not friends with each other, they have the same mom who drove them to the same karate club in the same pickup truck or minivan. And so they were forced to split each other, and that's not part of the data set. So I don't think we should be striving for the same age as the historic example. I like actually when our algorithm does this something different. We asked 17 to make its idea of community, and it gave us 17, which is part of your own community, all the way through the purple. That's what 17 thinks of this community. We asked 24 what its idea of community is, and it gave us all the red together with the purple. So there's an overlap, and I think an overlap is appropriate. These purple people are somehow the in-between people, and they might go either way in the split, and they're sort of known as tightly bound to either community. In any case, we would expect J's notion of its community to be symmetric with I's notion of its community. I might think you're my friend, but I think I'm your friend. And that's just what's going to happen with a local method of community detection.
Checking other ones, do they pretty much agree? How about the agreement on
them? I'm going to put together a sort of a survey method to ask lots of members or everybody what their notion of community is. And we have a way of tallying the information together, because it's not, we don't expect to have the same results every all the time.
No, but I would expect similar.
Otherwise, similar results. It's a community. And so you have just asked me, I should do this next slide. A global application. So can I start the algorithm from all n vertices, or some large fraction of the vertices? and need some way to relate the results from the disparate ones.
Right.
That's what I need. So I'm going to apply something called a membership matrix. I'm going to say, and this is not an adjacency matrix. Typically, I presented this to and didn't say it was not an adjacency matrix. I think it's a matrix of zeros and ones, so it must be an adjacency matrix, and it's not. I'm going to put a 1 in ij. If j thinks, I thinks j is a member of I's community. And I'm going to put a 0 there otherwise. And m is an n by n matrix. If I'm asking all n vertices, and it's an n by m matrix, I'm going to survey m of the n vertices. And this is the kind of result you get. When the result is exceedingly clear cut, like this one, you get this picture. Red means 1, blue means 0. So everybody over here agreed. Everybody over here agreed. And number 16 thought that, everybody thought 16 was a part of this community. And everybody here thought number 16 was part of the community. That's why I have this little square in there. Here's an example of 3 obvious communities. And the same kind of little instrument, they're saying kind of fault. But number 16 thinks it belongs to both communities.
So is that just 16 showing up in a connection, or will you get other ones like 7 there? Because if you do your that local algorithm you had before, mm-hmm. it seems like you would get farther than 16 and you dip into the other group. If you pick like 17 as your starting vertex.
I forget to see if 17 or 16 is when they showed up.
Well, I imagine I would think both of them. That's what I was wondering.
Well, there might be a big drop from 17 from the first one to the second one, because the second one probably has a new one or something. So 17 might not include 15.
But if you consider all the vertexes coming over, all the lines coming up from 17, we draw the circle around it, I think you wouldn't get that drop, right?
Well, yeah. Oh, but the first one, you get a lot of people, most of them on top, and the second one, you get.
You start at 17. 17 says, I have all these guys who want to be at 16 too. What's on the next step?
So 17 is connected to everyone in that group?
No, but 17 doesn't see at the first step the big drop. It's where the big drop occurs that you draw a line. You say, now that my community.
But yeah, the thing is, I'm not sure that we see a big drop after our second line, right?
In a sense, it's just a minor indexing problem as to when we should stop the algorithm. Mm-hmm. But so it's like indexing your arrays on the other side of I or I minus 1. So it's always tricky to work out for X, but it is, as I say. If you start at 17, then I draw a ball around it, and at the first step, I see lots of edges emerging. On the next step, let me see if we drop with this guy. Okay, but those examples were drawn, they're drawn to essentially be solved before you even do anything. In general, it's going to be all mixed up. But start with the karate club, it starts from every guy to every guy, and I present the edges to the vertices in a random order. You typically get a result that looks like this. And I need some way of permuting the rows and the columns so as to make it look as block diagonal as possible. So I need a cost function that tells me if I've done a good switch to bring it closer to this. And so the cost function is going to be this. I'm going to try to match a row. I'm going to row that consists of zeros and ones. I'm just going to subtract zeros and ones from the rows and subtract, and try to make it be a large fraction of those that can be matched. So if I can switch these two, and I can switch these two as well, because that's basically a renaming operation, and I find that I get a better matching between them, I keep the switch. And I start at the top, I switch these two or not. if they match, I keep the switch, and then I switch these two, and then I switch these two, and so forth. And it turns out it brings you to a position that looks more or less like this. If there is a position like that. Running that operation on graphs that look like this, where I don't draw them so nice, I present them in a relatively random order. The algorithm does bring me to nice positions, and you can show that. I didn't show the details of proving that, but it's very simple kind of a proof. For this particular graph, when you present it as, let me show you what the graph is. The graph is books from Amazon.com. And when two people bought a pair of books, there's an edge drawn between them. So you know, you go to Amazon, you can buy a book, and it says, do you like to buy this book too? If you do buy this book too, it says, book I and book J have an edge between them, whenever somebody did that. And it turns out people like to buy books that say more or less the same thing. So, but that's not assumed. But this just turns out to be so when I tell you what the books were about. Anyway, the books are presented in a random order, and then the switching operations bring you to this position. And then I draw it, and it obviously looks like community, but if I just presented the data initially as a big list, it wouldn't have been so obvious. It turns out that the books on here are written by well-known Democrats, and the books on here are written by well-known Republicans. And I think it means that Republicans like to read books about Republicans and so forth. And I guess these are the swing voters. So I guess it means you write a book on politics while you're doing it is preaching to the saved or the cursed, depending on which way you're blue or pink. Not to mean red or blue, red or blue. This is another popular graph in the community. It's from the News Lab. And so if two members, two cast members, or two characters in the News Lab appear in the same scene together, there is an edge drawn between them. And it's a much more complicated graph, and it didn't divide nearly as nicely into communities. But it's kind of hard in your conflict to think of lots of characters and have them interact with lots of other characters, and it turns out they tend to be characters that interact amongst certain groupings together. And some of them are Christian. Like Myriad interacts with these folks. So some groups are Christian very nicely in little communities, and some don't. This dark blue, it thinks of the same community as by this communication matrix, but all they have in common is they're only friends with one person, and no one in particular. So I consider that to be a sort of failure. Actually, a very nice way of presenting a community is like this. It's called a dendrogram. So this permutation operation, what I'm going to do is use that same cost function, scan through until I see a large change in that function. You know that that comparing rows of zeros and ones, subtraction. That's essentially this function. For a very complicated community, this function will tend to have steps. And those at a particular step or approximate step you group together as a grouping member. Here's an image of an object example where it's not quite as trivial. And it's just, I think this lower end is a much cleaner way of presenting the data. Okay. So that's part two. And here's our paper. Here's the Newman paper that I think is the best global method out there. And of course, ours is the favorite, our favorite local method. Here's another Newman method that I like this paper very much as well. And here's the book on politics, at least. That's where you can find that data set. Okay. Now I'm going to show you something very interesting about cycles in graph. Cycles, you can call cycles like a backbone for the network. This actually, I was inspired by this by a very similar notion in a dynamical system. It also traces if you're an operator person. A dynamical system, you can say that the dynamics are very closely reflected by the periodic vertex. And I approached this initially by thinking there's something similar going on in large graphs. So that was the inspiration. I'll play what we found. I just gave you one of these, but I haven't got out of doing that. Play the motivation before we start. So I have a cycle on scale-free graph. I have a deterministic scale-free graph, and I have a sampling method for random scale-free graphs. So the idea initially was what I told you about the backbone. And you make this large graph, which represents a probability distribution function in a sense, but it's also a construction method. You can show that degree distribution by no means determines the graph, or even the class of graphs. For example, you can have a Barabasi scale-free graph with your degree distribution and a particular exponent, with lots of loops, lots of other of these measures like average clustering coefficient, graph diameter, and even the distribution of cycles. one is purely a tree, meaning there's no cycles at all, and the other one might be the Varavasi graph. It's a dramatic kind of a graph forming. It's a tree, one it's not. So we're going to pick out something called a cycle exponent. So let me tell you what a cycle is.
So networks and cycles. So I would say an H cycle is a closed path through H connected links that's self-avoiding.
So in other words, if you do a figure eight, and you in the middle came through and went through this guidance, this isn't actually one cycle, this is two cycles.
I'll say NH is the total number of distinct H cycles in the network.
Only distinct, because if we don't say distinct, then if you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, that's one cycle, and then 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, that would be another cycle, and I don't count that as two separate cycles.
And it'll say H star is something surprising from over. It's the size of a typical cycle in the network. Turns out there's a typical cycle length. Let's see if that is in a second. The idea of a cycle is well defined. You could say I can find all the cycles by a low-level algorithm called depth first search. It's a great algorithm, it's very robust, and you just can't run it on any reasonable size graph because the number of cycles scales exponentially with cycle length, which means even for a graph of, say, 50 vertices and a reasonable number of edges, your program's just not determinate. You can try, but we did try. We discovered this by the Bowman way, which is writing a simple algorithm, running it, didn't finish in an hour, so it ran overnight, ran overnight, still didn't finish, and then started getting some complications. You figure, oh, it's going to take 10 foot to make 2 million years. Full distribution of cycles of all sizes, we're going to get at this by another method. And it's extremely expensive. So here's a picture of a cycle. Here's a 5 cycle. It's a loop that doesn't cross over itself. As far as I know, we were first to study this, but a whole bunch of other people have been studying this in just the about 2 years since we started it. Here's a bunch of other papers on the same topic. I think we're the root. Okay, here's a great graph. We really like it. It's a playground for a lot of things that we can play with. This kind of graph. But this is a construction as follows. It's a deterministic scope graph. So you make it in generations. I'll say let generation 0 just be 2 vertices and the edge between them. I'll say there's no over here. Generation 1, I'm going to draw a triangle. In generation 2, on each edge of the triangle, I'm going to hang another triangle. In generation 3, on each edge of the triangle, I'm going to hang another triangle. I just keep hanging triangles on triangles on triangles on triangles. The picture basically tells the story. This naturally, you can see, makes hubs of various scales. It has a scale-free nature. And you can show quite rigorously with this constructive example. But it's this constructive example refers to these folks. Do you want to go? Please forgive me. If you can be back and if you can speak the language, pronounce it for me. In 2002, the degree distribution you can prove is scale-free with this scaling exponent, 1 plus log of 2 over log of 3. There's another way of constructing this same guy by thinking of it as a self-similar object. And this is actually what we'll do to count cycles. You can say, produce generation n, there it is. And then from the hubs, call, for example, A and B, take me 3 copies of it and tie them together, just like this. And you can show that this makes the same scale-free graph at the limit. Now we can count cycles by making rate equations. This is a very favorite trick in statistical physics. You see it over and over and over. It's basically chemistry. I can make rate equations in chemistry. You say, let's remember that n of h is the number of cycles at generation n. And I'll say l of h is the number of paths of size h between 2 hubs in generation n. And we're going to build cycles by piecing together these paths, L sub H. We just tie them together. And then the other paths we already counted in the previous generation. So I'm going to skip the last part of the talk. We'll just enjoy this part. Anyway, the chance of, well, how are you building
cycles at the next generation. They're built out of all those guys you already had, plus you tie together previous paths between hubs, and in a sense, this is an assumption of statistical independence. Except it's not statistical quantity, but that's what it would mean in chemistry, when you're building rate equations in chemistry. Okay, and then you need to make a couple of equations that tell us how those paths grow. And what's great is these are solvable systems, and I can show you the steps. I'm sorry, I take that back. You hope they're solvable systems. In this particular project, it's not solvable, but it's recursion. So we can make an n finite n, and we can tell you what the values are. And we do ask the powers for the long one, but we can't solve it closed form for finite n. But anyway, when you run your computer, you can count the number of cycles of a particular length. And these are the results. So what's the probability, how many cycles of length h are there for a particular h? Notice this is a log scale. Something very interesting happens. So each of these curves is successive n's, which means successive generations of building your graph. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is, I think this is generation 6, and you can already see that the number of paths of length 100 is absolutely huge. E to the 80, it seems like a computer program didn't finish. You can't count something that's the size of E to the 80 on the computer. Anyway, we get this shape, which if you remove the log, essentially looks like that. It's tightly peaked. What this means is that there's a characteristic pathway at the maximum, and actually that maximum, its position scales linearly, which is going to be this hypothesis. But that there is a characteristic path length, I mean a loop length, means far and away, majority of the loops in the graph are on a particular length, say 37 or something. And all the others you can essentially statistically ignore. And that, when I had the word rigidicity in my title, I was referring to this. So most cycles go through the major hubs. And since they wander around as much as they can wander around, and all the other cycles, they essentially do more or less the same thing, and they go to mostly the same places. If you're taking some statistical average on your graph, they don't need to survey over the entire graph, or even over all the cycles, all E to the 80 of them. You just take a handful of these characteristic cycles, and do whatever average you want on those. So in that sense, it's meant to be a statistical estimator, very ergodic estimator. The position of this H star turns out we find looks like this for this closed flow example. It scales as 2 to the n. And in general, by some minimalization arguments, we find that it scales according to the size of the graph. N to the alpha, where alpha is log 2 over log 3, anywhere that log 2 over log 3 appeared in this scale of the graph previously. And we think this alpha is actually a very interesting characterization of the graph itself. So if you could get at this alpha in general, I think that would be a really good characterization of, since how connected the graph is, how tight the globule it is, and so forth. We repeated this kind of calculation for other graphs. You can show that for a lattice meaning the graph essentially looks like this, and then by n lattice, that the alpha will have to be 1. We built it for the Sierpinski gasket. We found alpha is 1. You can show for a complete graph alpha is 1. So something very special about this scale free graph.
Is it related to dimensionality? Related to lattice of dimension d?
I forgot the answer. For what you mean for the lattice of dimension d?
Yeah, it's a triangle or square lattice of dimension d.
That slipped off the tip of my tongue in my memory, but I think the answer would be the same for dimension D lattice, finite dimension. In a sense, it's not a measure of the dimension of lattice itself, but for how connected it is amongst itself. Now, for a random scale-free graph, we can't do this thing close form because you have different instances of its construction. So we can't do the survey because the counting all cycles doesn't converge. But the idea was supposed to be that if you take just a good sample, a survey, sort of survey, What do the pollsters say? A poll. When you take a poll of just a few cycles of a given of each length, that it will be representative somehow. So that's what we do. We make a random walking algorithm that walks randomly. We throw in the instance if it self-intersects, and we keep those that eventually come back to the starting point without intersecting somewhere along the way. We have some ways of trying to make it less biased than that would produce. Anyway, we do counting by that, and we find a distribution that aligns us with the previous one. So we believe our results with the scale pre-K, the deterministic scale pre-K is actually representative of a much broader class of randomly distributed scale pre class. But we can't prove that at this time. Here's an interesting little note. Counting cycles tells you a lot as opposed to just the degree distribution. And this is a bit of a critique of a lot of work I see in literature. It's very hard. Scale free means there's the chance of having a vertex at a very high degree is very small. Scales as k to the minus lambda, which means the tail is going to be very light, very few members of it, which means you need a very large graph to even see a tail. And yet you see people writing papers that say, I see a scale free graph of 400 vertices. And, you know, any sense of statistics would say, that's a little bit silly. Except, now, here's how you can actually show that, in general, a scale-free graph of 100 vertices, or just a few hundred vertices, is going to look essentially like this. This is 100 vertices. We can show that a scale-free graph of 100 vertices, on average, will look like essentially one shell, which is a set of vertex hub, with all those guys connected by one step, and then basically trees hanging off of it. So it's not scale-free-like at all, here for just 100 vertices. By the time you get to about, say, 400 vertices, it basically looks like a two shell with a couple of trees hanging off of it. So it looks more like K1 or K2, the complete graph, with little hair hanging off of it. There's the conclusion. So for large enough to show you that the distributed distribution resembles a delta function, and it peaks around some characteristic path length. I went to make one comment regarding that, I forgot to say. Why would it saturate? It's almost like a Berg process with a heating process. The corresponding to die-off, I'm sorry, in terms of dynamical systems. Which at first we expected exponential growth, and you expected first exponential growth from the number of cycles. But it's eventually there has to be a saturation, because there's a larger cycle length, it's called Hamilton cycle, it goes everywhere. And there might be just one of those. So somewhere between the three cycles and the Hamilton cycle, there's lots of the longest length cycle. And once you reach that longest length cycle, it's harder and harder to find paths that are longer, can go everywhere without self-intersections until eventually you have the Hamilton cycle if there is one. So there's a growth and then a tail off because of saturation. The exponent alpha we claim serves as a single figure merit that characterizes the loopiness of the net. That's what we call the paper, how loopy is your graph. Regular lattices are back to the complete graph, and the R graphs all turn out to be alpha is 1. So scale free, very interesting. Small random scale free graphs, we conjecture this, but we haven't shown it yet. There's good reason to conjecture it has a particular form. It remains an open question whether the loopy exponent saturates to off equals 1 as n goes to infinity. We can use a more efficient sampling method than what I told you for the random scale free graph. There's a bias built into it by throwing away those guys that don't self-intersect. But we don't know how to get around that at the moment. And even though the results remind us a lot of those for the deterministic case, so to say, I think it must be in the ballpark, we don't have any kind of proof because we biased our sampling.
Well, you just do some resampling. Right, that's how they can calculate, you know, how things that happen with probability 10 to minus 99 and interpolation or something like that, you know, using this pruning and resampling.
The dynamo material?
Well, I the perm. Yeah, well, no. I can show you some stuff later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Might be just our minor interest, but okay.
I think there probably is a way to do that.
Okay. And there you're going to see stuff I told you about. I'm going to show you one more slide, but I'm not going to do the talk. Not that one. Oh, cycles are important in the backbone. They also point communities. I lost a slide. Anyway, I'm going to show you that cycles somehow hold together communities. What I'm not going to show you, but just say look at my paper, is a notion of graphs that change in time. So most work algebra literature says the graph is built in time and stays put. And the slides I'm going to skip basically address this problem. What was I going to say, Carol?
Now just return to stuff.
Okay. Anyway, graphs can change in time. I was going to skip that.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's thank this chair. Any questions?
Okay. Sorry about that.
No, I think it's over. So I think the simplest question is, present your first part of your talk. Is it so that if you, if somebody would ask you how to become more famous scientist, you would just advise me to put more papers in the archives? Is it a good solution?
I guess the conclusion of what I said is that's not fame in the first place.
The more papers I put, the more famous I become.
Actually, if you look at the distribution, I've been pointing to it a lot. A lot of people lie along the middle line, and a few people are down here, and a few people are up here. And I think the people down here, they've written a lot of papers, but they're not so famous. I think they're writing the same thing over and over and over. We all know who those people are. They're overwriting. I think you want to be here or here, where you're writing those high-impact papers.
Okay, any other questions?
Yes. So one way to judge the impact, the scientific, is again, like Freed, it's already out there.
But that's self-referential, though, isn't it, in terms of what I was trying to say compared to other populations like movie stars and such, where people are talking about you in general, because who cites you but us ourselves, still within a small community. So I'm trying to give it a chance.
For merit, not for merit.
Oh.
One of the citations you have is the more accurate
reflection
of the quality of the work in some sense.
Oh, okay.
The quality.
I'm uncertain.
Your popular fame versus scientific fame.
So I thought about citation index in terms of fame, but I've been so stuck in that, I hadn't thought of using it in terms of merit.
Well, that's been done, actually. You get a Commonwealth distribution and a number of the citations per author, per paper, or whatever. You have this fat fail as well. So it works more like your real fame, in some sense, because the distribution of the citations is much broader than the distribution of the number of papers that are written.
You know, Vlani, a friend who did a separate study where he was looking at propagation of errors in citations. Like, you know, when you cut and paste out of somebody else's citation without actually reading the paper, and you put it in and you misspell my name, like everyone spells my name B-O-L-T, and you can watch that propagate.
Good question.
Can you just put up the slide with the data not again?
Which
your data and results for the citation, or the, I'm sorry, for the, even not the citations.
Oh, I did too many times.
Almost there. Awesome.
Okay. I'm going to see something. That guy down there, that was you.
Okay, any more questions, remarks, comments? If not, let us thank the speaker again. And just next week, I will present something about complexity in elections. So at the very end,